Before we get to this episode, just to say thanks to everyone who's bought my new book, Champion Thinking, How to Find Success Without Losing Yourself. Published by Bloomsbury, the response has been terrific. It's an Amazon bestseller. It's been top 20 in the airport charts consistently, and the reviews have been terrific right across the board. And if you like this episode that you're about to hear on Flow, you'll be sure to enjoy Champion Thinking. Head to my website, simonmundy.com, or Amazon, Waterstone, Smith's, places like that, to get your copy.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Don't Tell Me the Score. My name is Simon Mundy, and this week I am talking to Goldie Sayers. Now, Goldie was Britain's best javelin thrower for a decade, an Olympic gold medalist, and friend of the show. In this episode, we are talking about flow. We refer back to the episode I recorded with Rupert Spira on the philosophy of sport. And I know that that episode pushed the boundaries for some people, while others were really touched by its possible implications. So Goldie was one of those who it really did resonate with. So we bring the subject back to sports, as well as her experiences of flow, of choking as well, and really talk about getting out of your own way, as well as other related matters. I hope you enjoy our conversation. And just before we get to it, I just want to say thank you to a few people who've left some really kind reviews of late. Nick, Chantal, Cody, Michelle, Malcolm, Bill, just to name six, but there have been so many others as well. And as ever, everyone who's been in touch with me, thank you to you too. My website is simonmundy.com, and I am easy to get hold of on social media at Simon Mundy. So please do get in touch with your thoughts, feelings, questions, and suggestions. Anyway, I look forward to hearing from you. But in the meantime, here is Goldie Sayers. Goldie, how are you?
I'm good, thanks, Simon. Yeah, really well. How are you?
I'm good. I'm delighted to chat to you as ever. It's a pleasure to have you on. And I want to start by making you a little bit uncomfortable. Something that has been a really nice side effect, added bonus of doing Don't Tell Me the Score that I never expected from the outset is having made friends with guests, so people who've come on the podcast, as well as listeners. I would consider you a mate now, and it's a very nice thing that I've got from Don't Tell Me the Score that I wasn't expecting. So I wanted to just start by saying thank you. We're chums and I like it.
No, thank you. We've had lots of little exchanges during lockdown as I've been listening to other Don't Tell Me the Score episodes, and then it sparked an idea and I've texted you, I know you need to interview this person or on this subject. And you've got me through lockdown, I think, and so is the podcast. So no, thank you, more to the point.
Oh, bless you. That's very kind. And so we've covered loads of things before, haven't we? Your story, and I'll just quickly do a bit of a recap. So obviously you won bronze medal at the 2008 Olympics, which was initially fourth, but there was a drugs cheat and you didn't get it until, 11 years later? 2012, you were in the form of your life and then you decided to chuck a javelin for one last time at a meeting, a couple of weeks before, and managed to do your arm in, so scuppered your hopes. But you were in that top echelon of favourites, weren't you? You were up there with like your Ben Ainsleys and whoever else considered to be real contenders.
Yes and no.
You were considered a strong medal contender, weren't you? Admit it.
Yes, when they were scraping the barrel, my name might have come up as a medal contender.
You'd beaten everyone in the weeks before, hadn't you?
Yeah, no, in that competition in which I injured myself as well, I had beaten the world record holder and was winning by a couple of metres.
There we go. But we've spoken on previous podcasts, we've spoken about how you look back on your career and appreciate the people you met, who you became, the journey of it. You've given a really, really valuable exercise in terms of working out your values, and values is obviously something I talk about a lot. And today we're talking a bit about flow, because I had that episode with Rupert Spira out, which was about the a philosophy of sport, as it was called. And I knew that it was testing the boundaries a little bit of episodes on Don't Tell Me the Score. And some people really loved it. Other people I know just, it went right over their heads. And what did you make of that conversation that we had and the subject itself and all that stuff?
I just in words, because I don't think I can describe it completely properly, but overwhelming. I think if it's like a, you know, emoji on a phone, it would be one of those head exploding emojis for me anyway, probably 10 times over. But also, but really inspiring, but mainly really, really thought provoking, ironically. So, you know, knowing we were talking about this today, you know, I was up last night just thinking about, you know, all my sort of lived experiences. It does make me quite overwhelmed, actually, but really excited as well. And yeah, so I hopefully we'll cover it in some way today. But it's definitely, definitely worth a listen. And I think there's so many layers to it as well, that I've listened to it several times, actually, now. And you hear different things every time you listen to it. And it's quite exciting. And, you know, I almost think like Rupert for president, really, or prime minister. But when I saw the video of him, because obviously you listen to these people, and if you don't know them beforehand, you have a picture of what they might look like in your mind. So I sort of thought, oh, you know, grey-haired professor in a darkened room, and then saw his video, I think, on your Instagram. I'm like, he looks like a Hollywood kind of superstar, doesn't he? And he's so present and in the moment and so full of passion about it, but he's just quite mesmerising. So, yeah, I'm a big fan in summary.
Well, that is a ringing endorsement. Now, he's a lovely man. I mean, were there any bits that stood out for you or that really got your mind whirring?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I remember where I was when I was walking, listening to it. And I think I WhatsApped you the view of me having listened to this bit where he mentions, you know, this portal, you know, that you can, you know, people can access. It's effectively the essence of what it means to be human or a greater intelligence. And for me, that sort of took me right back to, you know, the Beijing Olympics and, you know, a performance or a throw there, and almost feeling, you know, like I'd been sort of beamed up somehow, and or as if this portal had opened. And it's that moment. And I think it probably was pure sort of joy, peace, almost calm of, wow, this is, you know, I kind of almost like I get it now. It you know, it sort of makes the whole world make sense when you have moments like that. And it's not as if, you know, my whole career was full of moments like that. It absolutely wasn't. But that's, I think, what you can remember as a sports person is those amazing moments when you're in the moment. And, you know, two of my best performances, I remember a lot about it. I don't remember the, like, every step of the throw or anything, but so that was a big thing, I think, for me. One of his greatest lines, I think, in both sections that you did with him, was this statement, I think it should just be on every like poster in every school and office, is disconnecting from our ego system and reconnecting with our ecosystem. I just think is genius. I don't know if he came up with it, or it doesn't matter, because most of these ideas are kind of, you know, recycled in some way. But, you know, just, I guess for me, the experience of lockdown and everything else, just being in nature is so important. And so having moved as a result of that effectively to sort of South Devon, and I'm listening to the podcast now, walking through woods and with the sea, you know, next to me. And it just, I don't know, I mean, that is so important, as we all know, for so many different reasons. Oh, God, so many things. And like going in within to find kind of effortlessness. You know, that made me think about, you know, pre-throw routines, and actually it's within you anyway. You just have to get out of the way of it, or out of the way of yourself, sorry, to let, you know, things happen. And it's also why we need to create space and time, most importantly. It's almost like slowing down to speed up kind of thing. Oh, just so many. I could talk about it for a week, but I think people would probably press pause on their phones or whatever.
Obviously, I framed it, or we framed it, really around flow, that experience of flow. And I remember you talking in detail about one of your throws in Beijing 2008, when you were, you felt like time was slowed down. And can you just take us back to that, what that moment was like in 2008?
Yeah, so I think, you know, thinking about flow, I think you can be in flow a lot, and maybe that's around, you know, doing, having done the training, and but perhaps those experiences are primarily based on past experience and knowing what the movements are and not thinking. But there is probably what I experienced in sport occasionally was a kind of heightened awareness. And so my experience in Beijing, you know, it was awful, awful conditions, you know, no one really should have thrown that well, but you know, it was one with pretty much a world record. I broke the British record in the first round, but I knew I only had that one round because we were told that it was going to pour with rain at 7:27 and we started at 7:20, so I knew I literally had 4.5 seconds to kind of perform effectively. And you know, I was in great shape, but the preparation was awful. I had food poisoning. A lot went wrong, so you know, it was quite chaotic leading up to that point. But just in terms of being in flow, just a feeling of, bearing in mind, I think the javelin actually as a, I want to say art form, but it kind of is in a way, it is almost the epitome of flow, because you cannot try at any point. And that was what was so challenging, but also so lovely training for it, was the fact that you have to get out of the way of it. So you can't, the minute you think, and you will have thoughts that will come and go during that 4.5 seconds or whatever length of, you know, elite performance throw was. Mine was like about 4.45 seconds. But the actual throw itself might last, you know, 1/16 of a second. But when I was, you know, performing really well, that 1/16 of a second, you know, I'm convinced you can play with time and stretch it and stuff, because I could just, you know, it was like it was sort of happening to me, I guess. And I listened to Johnny Wilkinson's podcast, and that feeling of, you know, being aware that it's happening, but, you know, it's almost happening to you in a way. But just that 1/16 of a second probably felt like, I don't know, 20 seconds or something. And you just, the only way at the time I could describe it, because I hadn't, you know, learn about, you know, non-duality and everything, was in layman's terms, and I feel like a bit of an idiot saying it now, having listened to Rupert, but having watched the film Limitless, where Bradley Cooper kind of takes this pill and almost the whole world kind of opens up, or he can access another side of his brain. I mean, that's sort of what it feels like, which is, you know, possibly why I'll never, you know, turn to drugs, because I feel like I've experienced that already. And maybe that's what people love about drugs. I don't know. But, you know, yeah, so that was, it's a sort of heightened, very, very heightened state. And then, but I wonder whether in order to access that, if we're talking about everybody being connected, and when you're in a stadium where the thing that you're sort of competing for means so much to you, but it more importantly means so much to the whole audience, then I think maybe, I don't know, this is my hypothesis, but maybe you can access that to another level. It's an incredible, incredible experience.
So when you were in that 4.5 seconds, or specifically the 1/16 of a second, when you were actually throwing the javelin, in what sort of detail were you able to recall what is such a short period of time that actually it should go by in a blink?
Yeah, and whether that's just your memory sort of playing tricks on you, I'm not sure, but it sort of all starts at the start of the throw, which for me is sort of a pre-throw, or was a pre-throw kind of routine, where, you know, I'd kind of skip to the back of the run-up, sort of create a bit of energy within myself. And then obviously in an Olympics, you've got 60,000, 80,000 people, kind of really intense environment. So then what I would as a routine, just bring it very, very internal. So take some deep breaths, then almost take that energy to my, I used to sort of use my sort of stomach, I guess, and then feel my feet, just so I had some sort of, I just calming everything down effectively. So just completely, yeah. So you're effectively, I guess it's, I didn't know it at the time, but I was effectively kind of doing a mindfulness kind of exercise in a very, very heightened state. And then I'd run through what I was about to do, or like a perfect, in inverted commas, throw, or what I wanted to happen. So I'd see it in my mind. And I'm quite, you know, from a musical family, so I'd basically say a rhythm to myself. It looks like I'm talking to myself. But the rhythm of the throw, which effectively, if you were to put a stopwatch on it in my mind, it would be exactly the same time as the throw that I was about to do. So see it, feel it in my body. And that's the point at which you just have to let go of everything and let it happen. And then you do it. So see it, sort of feel it in your body, having visualized it, then do it. So whether what you've just about to do or doing is actually what you've just visualized, or whether it is actually what you've done, I don't know. But there was just a moment, because when you're performing, you have to almost kid yourself that you're about to do something great, because you have to quiet in your own brain and thoughts. So often I think I would do this quite funny thing where I'd start to hear the pattern of my feet. That's so I knew sort of 3 steps in whether it was going to be a decent throw or not, but kind of halfway down sometimes I'd go, and I remember doing actually in Beijing, I don't know if it's on the first round or not, but I go, oh yeah, to kind of convince myself that I was going to be, you know, about to be great. I did. I'm being very honest. I don't think I've ever said that before anywhere. And then you sort of have to get into, so my throw is effectively like 16 steps. It's not very long, but all you can relate it to, I think, if, you know, to most people listening, if they've played golf, it's a bit like trying to hit a perfect golf drive off a 25 meter run up. There's a lot of variables that can get in the way, not least yourself. And there is time to think, but you know, that's absolutely a no-go. But there's a point in the javelin, in the penultimate sort of stride, we call it like the impulse, which is effectively just time in the air to kind of create this slot. It's what it sort of feels like effectively. And I think it was probably at that moment when I'm like, oh yeah, that feels nice. But it was like that speed in my mind. And it wasn't me judging it. Well, I suppose it is you judging it, but it's just, it is an awareness. It's just awareness, really. And you have to base all your training, certainly in javelin, or I did, whether rightly or wrongly, on feelings, because you're taking on information from a coach or whatever and building this throw over a period of years and years and years. So you know what kind of good feels like, effectively, really. So, yeah, I guess I just remember this moment where I'm like, oh, this is, it's almost like joyful. I'm like, oh, this is fun. And or you'll feel quite at peace, I guess, and know it's about to be. It's a knowing, I guess, that it's about to be good, which is why people always say, you know, do you know that it's going to go a long way when it leaves your hand? It's like, well, you sort of know 15 meters back, but you definitely know in that slot position for me. So, and then that's at that point, you really have to get out of the way of it. So yeah, and I definitely had moments. I probably, in my best performances, actually, that was probably the most flowing, I guess I was. And yeah, I would have been in flow to a degree in other performances and certainly moments in training as well. But there's definitely been moments that have been on a sort of slightly different stratosphere kind of thing.
So I did some research for the book actually about flow, and some of the research suggests there are two components of an experience of flow. One is that less of a sense of self, and the other one though is a distortion of time, which it sounds very much like you experienced in Beijing. Quick question. When you start out and you're visualizing, are you doing that from, are you seeing yourself doing it, or are you visualizing from like the first person perspective, like it's happening to you at that moment?
Yeah, there's different ways of doing it, I think, but I would definitely be, I was actually doing it from the first person. So from, yeah, sort of deep within, in terms of what I could see, feel. So something that was always important to me was, because javelin is such a closed skill and no one can get in the way of it or whatever, is the minute you know where a competition is going to be, so in Olympic Games, you sort of want to get a picture of what the back of the run-up looks like, so you can actually see the picture that you're going to see in, I don't know, Tokyo or Rio or Beijing or wherever. And then you can make the sort of clarity of that picture and that visualization even more powerful. I think visualization is so powerful, or can be. But yeah, I'd always see it. It's sort of, I guess I would feel it in my body actually when I'm thinking about it now, but possibly see myself doing it as well. But it would definitely be me throwing. I think working with younger athletes who are trying to get their head around visualization, sometimes I say to them, pick someone that you really enjoy watching throwing or whatever sport you do, and almost imagine yourself in that person or what it would feel like whilst they're still sort of trying to model a really good technique, whatever. It was a big part of my sort of pre-throw routine, which is there for all manner of reasons, really, but not least to sort of calm yourself down and take your mind or yourself out of it a little bit.
So, yeah, I thought I struggled with visualization. And part of that, I think, was when I tried to do visualization, I would imagine me doing something, if you know what I mean. So it's like I would imagine an image of me doing something, so I felt somewhat detached from it. And then quite recently, I put it this way, it's to do with my upcoming wedding, right? And I imagined myself on the steps, but looking out as if it was happening then and there. And the difference was really huge. I suddenly noticed that, I had the feelings of like it was happening then. So I felt a little bit nervous. It was like people were watching me rather than happening to someone else. And then I was like, that's where I've been going wrong. It's to visualize in the first person rather than the third person. For me, I think seems to be more of an effective way of doing it.
Yeah. No, I definitely, definitely did a lot of first person in terms of you want to embody that experience so you can be present. It's about trying to be as embodied as you can be when you have got this racing mind and a deep thinker, and I know you are as well. Your mind does race a lot.
Oh yeah, big time. So it's interesting. So you basically, for when you had this experience of flow in Beijing, so you know, you've done all the drills, right? So you've done all the training, like you've painted a picture before, you know, it's not glamorous. You're in a field chucking a spear and making the tweaks and you're doing all that, and you've done all the physical prep, so you're in great condition. And then on the day, you've only got a very limited time. You know that first throw has to be it. You're visualizing what you're going to do, and then you start the run up. But then it's like you have to let go. And kind of let it happen. So you put all the work in, but then you have to let all the work go to let it happen.
No, absolutely. And that's the, it's almost like the difficulty, actually, I think, for a human being. And in my sport, it was literally letting go as well. We were talking before, is, you know, the one thing you can't do is try in javelin throwing until literally the last split second, and that's the only time that you can really sort of let go, like actually kind of unleash anything. So I describe it as, you know, getting out of your own way, like getting out, you know, sort of getting out of the way of yourself, and it is letting go. And I think that's where, when people talk about being kind of vulnerable, actually, you know, in a lot of, everybody's talking about, you know, not everybody, but say Brené Brown or whoever, you know, might talk about being sort of authentic and vulnerable, I guess that is about letting go. And I've had some fantastic conversations with sort of elite performers, and I remember talking to a sort of prima ballerina, and I just said, I'm fascinated by high performance, and I said to her, what do you think is the key to high performance? And she said, the ability to be vulnerable. And that is kind of, I guess, the sense of letting go and stuff. I thought that was an amazing thing.
I'll have to get her on. She sounds fascinating. So vulnerability and authenticity for me go hand in hand. And a nice description, I think, of authenticity is the absence of acting. So the absence of trying to control anything. So it's just turning up and you're almost exploring your own reactions in the moment. Like you're having no agenda. You're not trying to influence anything. It's like you're an observer to your own reactions and you're being true to them. And I'm glad you said about getting out of your own way, because I think this is a really interesting subject. So this idea of getting out of your own way, what does that mean to you?
Oh, wow. I suppose it's important to know that before that point, you will have had to have done the work and everything else. It's not kind of an absence of like kind of just completely letting go and not caring, but there is an element of that as well, where you sort of have to, I guess, to a degree, not care, because that's sort of taking the ego out of it and being open to what is or might be possible. And I think that's where perhaps we don't ever achieve what we are potentially capable of, because we put limits on ourselves. And it is the like real greats who are open to the possibility of, you know, breaking the world record or whatever else. But in terms of, for me, getting out of your own way, it is that certainly from a javelin perspective, it was very much just not think, just do it. Like, it is just, I mean, Nike do have a great phrase, just do it. And maybe that's what it is. It's just do it. Like, if I'm coaching, especially in javelin, you can break the skill down and do parts of it to try and put it all back together. But usually, or 9 times out of 10 with an athlete, you'll perhaps pick on a specific cue and you can see their like cogs going in the middle of a throw, and inevitably it goes horribly wrong. So then you're like, right, that's what we're focusing on. So that's your intention. And then just let go, like just get out of the way of it and let it happen. It's just letting it happen. And then invariably it's like brilliant. And I guess you can relate that to a lot of things in terms of, you know, I think of any sort of performance, whether it's public speaking, it's exactly the same as sport. You know, you need to prepare, but then it's like, you know, getting yourself up for it, then just calming down and then letting it happen. And just, it's that, you know, just knowing that it's going to be okay as well, and not you getting super stressed about it and over preparing as well, or overdoing it. And that's the same in sport, of like trying too hard, but just allowing it to happen. And sometimes you will deliver better kind of presentations or speeches than others, but invariably when you're very present and in flow, that's when it goes well and you feed off the audience, da-da-da. And it's, you know, it's exactly the same thing, I guess. So, yeah, that's what I see it as.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Yeah, I've mentioned a few times in terms of this podcast how I prepare for it. So I'm very thorough in terms of the research I do, less so for this one because we've chatted so often, but very thorough in terms of the research I do. But then once you get into it, it's letting all that go, so not relying too much on the work that I've done. It's there, and it gives me that sort of sense of confidence or faith that the work's been done, so it'll be fine. But then it's like not, it's like holding on to it quite loosely. But yeah, you were saying about like you can see the cogs whirring, and when you said that, I was thinking of Roger Federer. So like when Roger Federer is in full flight, drawing gasps from the crowd, and everyone's like, oh my Lord, how's he come up with that? But then I can see sometimes, like I was there in the Wimbledon final in 2019 when he was playing against Novak Djokovic, and he had 2 match points, and you could see he was thinking, you could see he was in his head a bit. Therefore, the implication for me is getting out of your own way is not getting lost in thought.
No, absolutely. And I think all of us can see in sport, I mean, I love an armchair fan, but, you know, especially with a penalty, you can see when someone's about to kind of fluff it. And it's just because you can almost see the chatter in their mind. And that's the hardest bit in sport. And if you ask any team sport player, what's the worst bit of their sport, they'll say, you know, taking a penalty, or remember talking to a hockey player about it, you know, taking a penalty corner, and literally you are just passing the ball from A to B that you do in the game a million times. But it suddenly then becomes, you know, a must do. And that's when the cogs start wearing. But I guess it's just the ability to know that that might happen and not judge it, or then start adding to the story, like you were saying. And or, you know, having practiced so many times that you just don't allow that to happen. But that, you know, it's really hard, even for, you know, Olympians or whoever. It happens to everybody. It's just that you've experienced it probably more times on a bigger stage, so you know that that's okay.
Yeah. This is why I really like acceptance and commitment training therapy, whatever you want to call it, because the whole gist of it is that uncomfortable thoughts and feelings are very normal, and it doesn't matter whether you are an Olympic gold medal winner, a World Cup winner, you're gonna have uncomfortable or, you know, questioning thoughts and feelings. Like, they're just going to be there. The question is, like, how you relate to them. And I remember Johnny Wilkinson saying, if someone had blown the whistle just as in that moment before he was about to hit the drop goal and said, right, stop, and just have a think about what you're about to do, he said, you know, he would have rolled on the floor, pulled his knees up to his chest and rolled around going, please get me out of here. So, you know, those thoughts and feelings are going to come up. But what I think is interesting and it is how you relate to them. And the natural thing that I think people often do is perhaps either try and ignore the thought or feeling, or perhaps get into a dialogue with it. So it's like the thought might be, oh, I'm going to mess this up. And then you'll go, no, I'm not. And then you've got this kind of conversation going on in your head. Whereas the acceptance and commitment approach is to go, oh, there's the thought saying, I'm going to mess this up. Hello, thought. Come on in. Welcome it in. Then you're not going to battle with it. And it's just, you recognize, oh, it's just a thought passing through. Some thoughts we take as more serious than other thoughts, but actually a thought is just a thought. That's why I particularly love that modality, you know, of like not taking your thoughts too seriously and getting lost in thought, which can be, you know, the difference between fluffing a penalty or, you know, a javelin throw, or even getting a good night's sleep, you know.
Yeah, and I guess, and also another level to that is just, you know, even if you do kind of fluff your lines or miss the penalty or have a rubbish throw, you're going to live. It's not life or death as well. And so there's a comfort in that. And it's funny, when you're an athlete and in it, in a way you sort of feel, or maybe not have to feel, but you sometimes do kind of live under this illusion that it is life or death and that, you know, it's so important. And then when you retire, you just think, what on earth was that all about? Sometimes, but I do look, what on earth was I doing? Like lobbing a spear around, but I loved it, so I knew why I was doing it. Yeah, I guess when you go into anything, or anybody goes into any moment that's a really big deal for them at that point, you know, just knowing that they will cope, whatever the result, is comforting as well, and I think that helps in the whole getting into flow and acceptance and vulnerability and everything else.
Yeah, the thing about thoughts, obviously, is that they're always either about the thought about the future or the past. Like, you can't think really, like, by the time you've thought about the present, it's already become the past. So like, thoughts are always future or past, and like you say, they can be really serious. And I know you were saying, when you look back on your career, you're like, God, why was I getting so taking it so seriously? But The irony is that happens even on a really small level. Like, I know when I play tennis, social game of tennis with my friend, as I'm going to be doing tomorrow morning, if we're playing a set and it's 5-all deuce, I know that my anxiety levels will rise. And in that moment, it's like it's the most serious thing in the world. And no one gives a monkey's apart from me and him. And 10 minutes later, you know, it's irrelevant. But at that moment, and that's the thing about our thoughts and feelings, like they pretend that things are really serious. But actually, the majority of things just really aren't that serious. And it's seeing that they take us for a ride pretty easily.
Yeah. And it's, you know, birth and death, maybe they're quite serious. But actually, everything in between. If we just, I guess, took more things with a pinch of salt, or probably saw the funny side in things, it is so easy. And I say this, but I'm as guilty as anybody of probably overthinking things and taking certain things too seriously or whatever. But, you know, they have to have meaning, don't they, as well? But it is about, what you're saying, you know, separating yourself from that thought or from the experience sometimes as well, in just knowing, you know, that it's going to be okay, or what's the worst that can happen? We've talked about that before. You know, that's probably how I live my life a lot, is, you know, what's the worst that could happen? You know, it's not life or death. Nothing is life or death. And even if you got yourself into a major sort of situation, you know, you can invariably get yourself out of it or find help somewhere, or to a degree, I guess.
And also, you don't know, like, so you've said to me a few times that, so in not winning London 2012, that actually there are some blessings to that, because the way that you now have a flourishing other career, several other careers, actually, you do lots of interesting things. But therefore you're, in a way, you're not having to relive that. So oftentimes we don't know whether something that on the face of it is bad may have benefits and stuff like that. So even just judging things as good and bad, we can leap to conclusions pretty quick, and oftentimes they're not completely right.
Yeah, and maybe every kind of experience is good and bad, if you think of it like that, because there's probably a lot of downsides to becoming, you know, it's getting less so, I think, as an Olympian in terms of winning the Olympics and being Olympic champion. You know, there's a downside to that as well, you know, being uber famous. I mean, I couldn't think of anything worse than being famous. I don't know whether to say this or not, but I remember, you know, I was lucky in that I shared, you know, an apartment with Jess Venice Hill, you know, and so saw her whole, you know, 2012 experience, and I mean, incredible. But one of my, like, it was kind of a favorite moment because it's actually quite funny, but she just won the Olympics, and I'd barely seen her because obviously she's then, you know, this sort of global megastar and household name and everything else, and been having to do loads of interviews. And then she came back into the apartment, I think it was the following day or a couple of days later, I think. And she came in, and it's like, oh, wow, you know, just, it was a lovely, lovely moment just to spend, you know, 10 seconds with somebody who just, you know, really fulfilled every kind of dream and ambition and so much pressure. I mean, just, that was one of the most incredible things I think I've witness, was, you know, flying into London and her photo almost being imprinted in a field, and she's everywhere. And people do think that, you know, Olympic champions are these other kind of worldly beings, and they're not, they're just human beings. But she walked in back into the apartment, and then probably about 10 seconds later, this guy walks in behind her, and I was like, oh, who's this? And it was like Sean, I can't remember his name, but he was a bodyguard. Because she then had to say every time she was going to leave the village where she was going to go because of crowd control, because it just meant so much to so many people, and rightly so. It was amazing, you know, moment. And it was really, like, you know, it's actually quite emotional to just think about it, just to witness, having witnessed kind of history, I guess, sort of firsthand. But yeah, he had to be with her leaving the village because it was such a big deal. If people sort of spotted her, the stampede would happen. And just, you know, seeing her a few weeks later and just saying, you know, how's life? And her just being like, I just want to be able to go to, I don't know, Wagamama's or something. and just, yeah, there are sort of downsides. Okay, I'm sure there's many, many more upsides. But yeah, I mean, I reconciled certainly not being able to perform as I'd have loved to have done in 2012 because of sustaining that injury 3 weeks before, when I'd just broken the British record in the same competition. you know, was maybe that was a good thing because I don't have to live my life, you know, still talking about that, you know, 20 years later or whatever. Not that you have to, but people, it means a lot to other people, which is lovely. And that's why I love Olympic sport, is what it gives to the joy it brings to other people. So, yeah, but it's like, you know, you could say the same thing with coronavirus for some people. It has, it's been awful, but they've had to sort of change their lives completely. And actually sometimes that's created opportunity and made them see the world a bit differently, and they've had to, I don't know, change careers or whatever, and they will look back and think of it maybe as a good thing. For other people, obviously it's been awful, but yeah, it's interesting. But you could easily cling on to, oh, you know, what if only I'd done X, Y, and Z, and that was the worst moment of my life. But, you know, is it? I'm not sure. I don't think it probably was. I think it's made me have to sort of look at other opportunities, identities. You know, I suppose it's, you know, maybe how I've drawn comfort from a fairly rubbish kind of experience. But it was only rubbish at the point of it happening. After that, you'd sort of know what the ending was. So then you just have to deal with it.
And it didn't and couldn't and wouldn't have changed who you are, even if you had won gold, right? Like what you're saying there about Jess, you wanted to just to be able to pop to Wagamama's. You know, she was still Jess, but in everyone's mind, she was suddenly really different. And I think it was interesting talking to Tony Bellew. He's really grounded. And he told me a story about meeting Floyd Mayweather. And he had one woman massaging his head, another massaging his shoulders, another massaging his feet, while he explained to Tony Bellew how he'd won $900 million. And basically, Tony was like, he'd like lost touch with reality. And like, I'm sure you've come across people like this, and in whether it be in celebrity culture, in sport, you know, and that's the danger, isn't it? When you lose touch with just the fact that, you know, ultimately you're just a normal person.
Yeah, and that's what I do admire about Jess most, is that she has not changed a bit, like literally not. But maybe that's because she is someone who probably finds, you know, joy in the smallest things, like, you know, being with her family, the dog, walking in nature kind of thing. So I think if you can find joy in that, then you are more likely to be happy whatever happens, you know, in terms of whatever your goal is and whether you achieve it or not. I've definitely come across a few people who've, you know, been put on this pedestal, and it is quite dangerous. And I think it's dangerous for sports people especially, because I think that's probably happened to them from quite a young age, because it is you have to be at your best at, you know, late 20s or something, which is very unusual in other careers. You're never supposed to be at your best until you're probably in your 50s or 60s in other careers. But so they're sort of, I guess some people might be told that they're brilliant from day dot at school and, I don't know, through university or whatever. And so if you're not careful, you probably can kind of believe the hype and that you are kind of special or whatever. So that's where Rupert's podcast is so great, in that you are literally just, you know, you've kind of trained a lot and you've created this vessel from which you can tap into something bigger than you. And that's what I think I'm so grateful for, actually, when I'm now having listened to that, is just that I've had that experience. I'm just so grateful for that, well, that moment, really. It is interesting. It's definitely, and that's why I think, you know, especially in sport, athletes I would recommend sort of finding other things and passions that they're interested in, even if they don't, you know, have time, or they think they don't have time to pursue other areas of interest, or it's not going to detract on their performance. It's actually possibly going to make their performance better, in that they might understand themselves a bit better.
Yeah. And that's what I liked as well about what Rupert said about the truly great artists and performers are the ones who are humbled by their performance, rather than, you know, take it and personalize it. And I think the people who do start believing their own hype, so they take one small part of them, perhaps an ability to punch someone or kick or whatever it may be, and turn that into a reflection of who they are, when actually it's just this tiny small sliver that happens to be appreciated. And I think when people do lose touch with reality like that, you then become, you can't really have authentic relationships, you know? And again, it comes back to what I said at the start about something I'm really grateful with Don't Tell Me The Score is becoming friends with listeners and a guest, because you sort of realize that everyone's just on the level. And I think if you lose touch with, if you start thinking you're a demigod, well, you can't have that. You can't, the price you have to pay is an ability to have normal relationships. So, you know, it comes at as big a cost as possible. I remember Russ Harris saying a really nice thing. Do you want to be remembered at your funeral? If you could come back as like a ghostly apparition, would you like to be remembered at your funeral as someone who was kind and considerate of others and well-liked and well-respected and trustworthy, all those things? Or as someone who achieved something great and thought that they were brilliant, you know, like had a story in their mind of, oh, I'm wonderful. You know, it's like, no, it's obvious which the answer is, you know.
And it's interesting. So actually now, I mean, I've had to give some presentations on Zoom or whatever over lockdown. And I watched my Brit record, which was at Crystal Palace. And it was probably my favourite sort of performance. And I watched that now. And going back to Rupert's podcast, it's like I'm watching that going almost like, who is that? It's not me. Like, it's not me, because it's not me now. But I do watch it and go, wow, I actually, with that particular performance, I'm like, wow, that's it's almost like I watch that and go, that's flow. Like, that's it to me in terms of, because I know what that felt like at the time. But obviously being able to see it outside of your body, you know, is something that you obviously can't see when you're doing it. So be able to look back on that is really cool. But I'm just like, wow, that's, and then I think you do have that realization of, you know, oh shit, I was actually really good. Because you don't really, I don't think you, or maybe some people realize during their career. And I think that's what the big, I remember talking to Dan Paff about this, like my coach who you've had on the podcast. I asked him the question, what's the most difficult thing in coaching? And he said, to get athletes to realize how good they are. And I think he probably might have been talking to me, but I'm not sure whether he was or not. But you know, you don't think of yourself as this, you know, amazing, you know, demigod at the Olympic Games at all. You're just still the kid who loves the feeling of throwing. So it's interesting, sorry, what you were saying at the start there, like actually it's quite funny. You sort of look back and think, wow, God, and I didn't at the time actually think, wow, I just probably saw what was wrong with it and thought, well, I could improve this bit and that bit and stuff. Whereas now it's like, it's quite a nice, I guess it's sort of an acceptance that, yeah, actually I was pretty good. Well, certainly on that day it was. Sorry, I was going to say, it's a really good exercise to do actually, in terms of if you're another exercise point we did one before on like your values, like just looking at your funeral. It's quite morbid, but what would you want someone to say about you at your, say if you had to pick a couple of people to speak, what would you want them to say? So yeah, it's a good way of extrapolating sort of, maybe if you don't have to show it to anybody, but what you would want people to say, and it, you know, hopefully is that you were nice, you know, kind and help them do X, Y, and Z or whatever. It wouldn't be, oh yeah, that you won a bit of metal that you don't look at sort of thing.
Or even more, have a really high opinion of yourself. What I was going to ask you though is flow and how it contrasts with choking. So you said about when you're in flow, how time changed. And Johnny, for example, spoke quite eloquently about there being no me. So it's that loss of self, like you're not self-conscious essentially, right? Whereas obviously when we choke, or when, like when you said earlier, when the cogs are whirring about me, or how's this going to affect me? Are people going to be judging me? I hope I don't mess this up. It's all variations on that theme. And I just think it's quite revealing that in flow, according to research, it's that distortion of time and a loss of a sense of self. Whereas choking, you're a heightened sense of self-consciousness, or you are more self-conscious.
Oh yeah, I mean, I've got probably 100 more experiences of choking than in flow on a sort of great stage. I mean, you have like, I had hundreds more failures than sort of successes, or failures in inverted commas. Yeah, and it is just that, the difference between those two things, and being able to kind of tap into that. Often I think it's interesting, actually, sorry, it just sparked a thought of, in a sport where, if you think about, I guess, things like athletics, which is incredibly black or white in terms of performance, you know, you would think about, oh, you know, I had a bad performance and it was this distance, and oh, what people are going to think, oh, it's going to get published somewhere and all my competitors will see that I performed terribly at this point. And actually, no one gives a toss, really. Like, actually, and when, it would have been nice to know that. So they don't, do they? I mean, no one's going to lose sleep over, I don't know, a 58-meter throw or something early doors. Or and I think the great performers are those who don't care, actually. And I like Josh Butler's podcast about, you know, having the effort on his bat or whatever. And actually, if you think, in cricket is a bit like that, in that everybody lives by their data. And, you know, real kind of cricket nerds will know everybody's kind of, I don't know, economy rate or whatever. And people like sort of Kevin Peterson, these guys, you know, don't care. And it is that ability to not care, actually, sometimes that really, really helps. But you can go down that rabbit warren. What will people think? And we've talked about, you know, social media, and that's, you know, you can totally go down there if you let yourself, in terms of what people are going to think of X post or whatever. If, you know, I've listened to a lot of people talking about social media and anxiety around that, and it's part of the reason why I don't get particularly heavily involved in it. So yeah, it is, you know, those moments of choking. It's not, I suppose, choking, people think that's like almost like the yips of literally not being able to perform, but you do have performances where perhaps your preparation leading in hasn't been ideal, and you start, your logical mind starts going, oh, there's so many reasons why I shouldn't perform, in terms of, you know, it's not been great preparation, da da da. You just hear all this chatter, when actually, and that's when the great, you know, athletes can just switch all that off and just be open to the fact that they could, you know, break the world record or whatever. And I didn't ever get there, I don't think, being honest. I think, you know, it took me, there were moments of it, there were sort of flashes of it, and it's so much less kind of stressful, certainly, to live in that world than to live in the what if kind of this happens, and, you know, being in the past or future and caring about what people think performances, because actually, you know, as I said, they really don't care. They don't care. I mean, you care, and probably your team might, but for different reasons, actually, I think.
Yeah, I think I've mentioned this before. One of my favorite videos on YouTube, it's called, it's by Alain de Botton, and it's called it's something along the lines of, we live in a world of staggering indifference, that actually we think people give a monkey's bass, but they don't, you know, they're so, everyone's so fixated on their own stuff that the amount of thought people give you is just minuscule. And on one hand, you might think, oh, that's a bit depressing, but actually, no, it's incredibly liberating. Like you say, you don't have to be as self-conscious and worrying and, oh, I've done this, I've done that, and I regret this and I regret that, and I'm guilty over this. It's like no one else is thinking about it, apart from it swirling around in your head. And you mentioned Josh Butler as well. And I'm, you know, he's one of those people I think I really admire, who's right, let's say, at the peak of his powers, and yet has managed to stay humble. And I think gets that kind of, you know, he had that really nice thing that he likes to read the paper front to back, so that he remembers that it's on the back pages, not the front pages. It's really not that important. And then Mark Webber came out with a nice quote, which was like, we're not trying to invent penicillin, mate. You know, slapping, I think it was Alistair Brownlee on the back before walking off. And it's like, that's a really nice, just like get things a bit in perspective. Anyway, I want to ask you something a lot of people have asked me about the separate self and the illusion of the separate self, right? What do you make of that? What do you think about that? Let's have a bit of a chat about that and see if we can pick it apart.
You summarise things much better than me. sorry, you might have to summarise it how you see it, and then it will spark a thought to me, because I'm now in my head going on. I'm now doing the whole not being in faith. What if I've got it wrong? And what if people see it differently to me, and I've got a responsibility here of doing the right thing or whatever?
So, okay, well, do you remember? I remember you and I chatting, and I did that whole we're not this, we're not that process. And you said that was quite, was that was quite a good, you found that quite a good one, didn't you?
Yeah. So
let's do that real briefly.
Okay, go on.
So it's like everything you experience in life is either a thought, a feeling, a sensation. So pinching your arm, that's sensation, a perception. So what you see, what you hear, what you taste, all that stuff. And everything anyone's ever experienced is one of those things. But all of those things come and go. None of them remain in perpetuity. But that which is aware of it, the thing that we call I, that is aware of a thought, is aware of what we see, is aware of what we hear, aware of the feeling of my bottom on the seat, the awareness that doesn't come and go. So it's separating yourself out from the objects of experience is quite a valuable thing. But then, so the separate self, which other people might call an ego or anything like that, is when we get ourselves muddled up, that awareness muddled up with thoughts and feelings. So thoughts about ourselves, whether that be, let's say, I'm great or I'm terrible or I'm this or I'm that. So it's basically, as far as I understand it, getting muddled up in thought.
Yeah. And then I remember when you did that exercise with me, or not exercise, but talked through that the first time. Like I can go back to where I was sitting. I can visualize where I was. And I went, oh no, why didn't I know that when I was an athlete? Because I was just like, should I have known? I just started questioning everything, thinking, well, should I have known that? And actually, if I could have just separated, obviously, my ego from the performance, it might have been better. But then I was like, oh, actually, no, it's just nice to know that now. but it's a really fine line, I think, especially in sport, because you have to have, in any profession, you have to have some sort of sense of ego. Otherwise, I don't know. I mean, that's kind of, we all have it, obviously. And well, no, exactly. We'd all be sort of horizontal. But actually, if I just saw it from a sporting context, if a sports performer is able to kind of, is again getting out of their own way again and separating their ego and just connecting, it's almost like plugging into, I sort of almost visualize it as like plugging into the universe, really. And I think everybody will have felt to some degree, even if it's just, I mean, I've probably had it this morning. I was thinking, right, how do I prepare for this podcast? Well, my go-tos are go for a walk in nature and just listen to something or music. And it's sort of feeling that joy and tapping into that to be present. But I think everybody has experienced something.
No, of course. I mean, yeah, look, goodness. Like you say, like we all have, everyone has an ego and a sort of a self-image and that kind of thing. But I guess for me, it's the degree to which we identify with it. And that's why I like that acceptance and commitment stuff, because or even mindfulness, it's like the ability to drop out of thinking and be like, oh, there's a thought and there's me. You know, I don't need to be lost in it the whole time. Like invariably, we always get back lost in it. But actually, at any time, you can drop out of it and be like, oh, yeah, I'm not my thinking. Oh, phew, what a relief. You know, whether that be worried or whatever storyline we have at that moment, you know, we always have that choice, like moment to moment. Just to finish things off then, let's talk a little bit about, though, identity. I know we have touched on it a bit, but, and I hope you don't mind me saying this, but so you said, you know, tell me off if you do. You know, you've been to classes recently, and sometimes you don't like to people to know that you know, you've been this Olympian and done this and done that and done, you know, whatever. Like that was then and this is now. But obviously a lot of people don't find that quite as easy as you. And we all sort of tend to lump ourselves in with identities of various things, whether it be, you know, an athlete or a business person or, you know, a parent or whatever it may be. But it seems to me like you're quite good at holding these things quite loosely.
Yeah, I think, I suppose having just moved to Devon and I needed to find a gym, and I thought motivation was never an issue for me as an athlete, but when you don't have a goal that you're sort of striving for, then motivation becomes an issue. So I prefer classes. So I just found an amazing sort of group training facility in the last like 10 days. And you obviously have to sort of do an induction, and you know, obviously people do not know who I am. You keep saying yes, they do not. And so they have to say, you know, have you lifted before? And I'm like, I don't want it to come up later. It's that thing, you don't want to embarrass somebody, or you don't want to go in with the big I am, yes, I'm a three-time Olympian and I'm an amazing athlete, because I'm not. Like, I'm not now, I was then. And, you know, I've not lifted anything in the last 12 months. I've kind of lived off Joe Wicks, God bless him, and some 5 kilo dumbbells. And there was actually a sort of strength session. I was actually amazed at how much like strength I'd lost. But it's, I had to say, actually, you know, I was an Olympic athlete, so I sort of know what I'm doing in the gym. But I find it incredibly rare that, you know, what I find interesting. I don't know, probably they either thought, oh, you arrogant so-and-so, or they were like, oh, felt a bit embarrassed. I'm not sure. I don't think they cared, really. They were just probably wanting me to sign up, as I would be if I owned the business. But then there's guys in there I find incredible, like doing, because circuits, effectively, you are working against yourself. It's not a competition, and you're just working as hard as you can. But there's women in there who are like 63 doing, you know, like 70 centimeter box jumps, which I remember chatting to one of them and just saying, God, I didn't want to say like, how old are you? But if I can still be doing that at 60, I'd be very, very chuffed. So, you know, everybody's inspired in their own way. I just think, you know, some sports people just got the opportunity, you know, or I always think in my career, certainly I met some amazing people at the right time. And I'm a big believer in when, you know, when a pupil's ready, a teacher comes kind of situation. So I was lucky in that I was open to seeing that, I guess. I do struggle with, we talked about it the other day, you know, and I don't know whether I should say this or not, but you know, Team GB, it's very much like once an Olympian, always an Olympian. So some athletes have a real issue with being called a former athlete or a former Olympian or an ex-Olympian. But I'm very, very happy with that, because I'm not. I can't do any of the things really that I used to be able to do very well. And I'm very, very happy with that, because I will never be in that shape or in that form for throwing a javelin ever again. And I, you know, you are just normal, you know, you are just a person. And I was very, not very average at certain aspects of training. I just had to work very hard at them. So yeah, I'm very happy with not being introduced like that. In fact, I kind of quite like it to come out later, because people have a perception of what you should be able to do. And it's not even that, it's just they you don't want to be treated differently, because I hate, you know, I have had experiences where people do treat you differently when they've heard or got wind that you did something, you know, 10 years ago that was quite good or whatever. Whereas I try to go through life, everybody is amazing in their own way, or, you know, everybody has a skill that they're good at or something that they're passionate about more so, I think. I just happen to be lucky enough to have found that thing quite early and really enjoyed it. I just had an opportunity and I had a passion for it. And it's, I guess it's just those two things. And I had a bit of probably, I don't know whether it's genetics or not, but I was quite flexible and skillful and could take on information. And that led to sort of that performance. I don't know. So yeah, I'm very, very happy with the term ex-athlete, because then you don't have to live up to it. As well, so that helps. I always talk to people about having, you know, like a backpack. I think Dan talked to that about me, or a psychologist he worked with. It's like, how much stuff do you want to put in your backpack to kind of walk through life with? And it's like, if you're taking on all that stuff of, you know, I'm an Olympian or an Olympic medalist or whatever it might be, it's quite a, if you buy into it, it could be quite a burden in a way, or heavy. And you have to live up to people's expectations. And actually, if you just meet people as a human being and human to human, and, you know, are they nice and you get on? And like, I just think everyone's interesting. Like, I don't know, it doesn't matter what they've done or what they haven't done. It's all kind of rubbish, really. I hate to say it, I shouldn't say that. It's not a good advert for your podcast, but it is all a bit of an illusion, really.
Of course, we want to strive to explore our, you know, skills, our abilities, explore like what life has to offer, try and, you know, live according to your values, try and show up, let's say, as the best version of yourself. But at the same time, know that, like you say, we're all just people, and like no one is any more important or less important than anyone else. And so actually, no, I think what you've just said is absolutely spot on. And that's why I really admire that about you and lots of other people who I've spoken to, who, you know, do hold it quite lightly and don't take it too seriously. And that can apply again in any role that someone has. Goldie, as ever, an absolute pleasure to chat. We will catch up again very soon, no doubt. But I very much always enjoy talking to you, and I very much appreciate you coming on again. So thank you.
Thanks, Simon. Thanks.
Thanks very much for listening to this episode of Don't Tell Me The Score with Goldie Sayers. I hope you enjoyed our conversation and took some nuggets from it. I always enjoy talking to Goldie. I'd be delighted to hear your thoughts, feelings, suggestions and questions. Do get in touch at Simon Mundy on social media, and my website is simonmundy.com. But that's it for this week. I hope you'll join me again next time on Don't Tell Me The Score. Until then, thank you. And goodbye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.